Accession number 9428, Reel 11.
Mr. Keel, Reel 10. You were describing your career in between the two wars, and you'd reached as far as coming back from the Far East and arriving in Tankerton.
Yes.
Perhaps resume your story from there. Could you tell me something about what you were doing in Tankerton?
Yes, I can. I'd been up with one or two little shows and variety, and then somewhere I was playing, a very well-known judge of talent and a man who used to run his own concert parties, and also was known as Wireless Willie. He was the first funny man, a pianist on radio. And I was playing on the pier, that's the pier at Herne Bay, and he came to see the show and sort of liked my wife and I, and he said, what are you doing next summer? We said, well, I haven't thought of that, it's too far away. I said, well, I'd like to book you. So he booked us at the Bohemia, that's at Herne Bay, and I had a couple of seasons there at Herne Bay, and then he took over a place at Tankerton, and of course I went there with him, and I liked it very much. In fact, after about a year or so, I kind of rented a house and kind of settled there. It was a very nice little place at Tankerton. And one of those small places where everybody gets to know you, and everybody knew me, and it was funny, really, what it was to me, that if you're liked, the kids flock after you, and I must have been their idol, because so many of the kids in Tankerton try to dress like me, wear hats like me, talk and walk like me. They try to do everything that Tommy Keel would do, and that was Tankerton, and I was there for 5 or 6 years, as I say. We settled there, and in fact my daughter was born at Tankerton, because Willie Rouse did a tour of Africa when I did a tour of America, and when we both came back about the same time, and he said, I'm going to settle down here, I'd like you to join me, Tommy. I'm going to convert this nice little house into a shop. Not into a shop, as a sort of lounge, and sell pianos and radios and things like that. And he said, there's a nice little flat above it. Would you like it? I said, I've never had a place of my own before. And so I took this flat above the music lounge, as it was called, and there we stayed for quite a while. And the sad thing was that I missed one of my big chances in the theatrical world. Soon after we opened it, Willie Rouse, who knew everybody, sent me to London to see one of the big impresarios. I can't remember his name for the moment. And he said, yes, I like what you've done. I hear what you've done this and done that. I'll book you, but it'll only be a small part, but you will get a showing in London. And silly little me, I said, oh, thank Waller. I said, Jack Waller. I said, sorry, Mr. Waller, but Willie started a music lounge and I've got a flat above it and I'm going to manage the shop for him, and I don't think I should want to come to London. Thank you, Mr. Keel, he said. That's the last offer I should ever make to you. I hope you get a better one some other time. I never did get an offer like that, because it's everybody's lifeblood to get a show that plays in London. I threw it away.
You regret that still?
Oh, I regretted it ever since, yes.
When you took up your work in the music lounge, did that mean that all your theatrical work
No,
was
it did. No. I could play our summer seasons, and I could pop away to do Masonics and dinners or variety or anything. I could do that because the wife will be looking after this, after the lounge. And if we were both wanted for a show, well, it was easy to find somewhere to look after the place for us.
Did your act change during this period, or was it much the same?
Well, no, you just learn different songs and learn different bits of patter. If you know that you're going back to a place many times, or it's natural, you'll try and find some scripts to do talking scripts. You try that. But otherwise, you can keep going back to different places using the same material. But if you constantly go to one place, you must change the material. Mm. And that was Tankerton.
What exactly was your job in the music lounge? Was that selling music, sheet music?
Willie actually was trading on my popularity. Oh, have you heard? Tommy Keel's got a music lounge. Oh, we must go and see him. What do we want to buy? We must go and see him. And they'd even buy all sorts of things, a mouth organ or a tin of things for playing gramophone needles, or they'd probably buy something decent, merely because Tommy Keel was there. Oh, I was, you know, the big noise, Tommy Keel.
That was in the area.
My son, who still lives there, he said, I met so-and-so, a very old person, and they said, oh, I remember your dad. Is he still alive? I remember him. I used to go to the Lawn Pavilion when he was playing there. I never missed a show of his. So I'm still thought of, apparently. I'm not swanking, but that's just what I hear. My son tells me that people say, oh, I wish to remember Tommy Keel.
Thank you. You mentioned a moment ago that you went on a tour of America. Could you tell me something about that?
Yes. Well, it's rather private, but well, it doesn't matter. I don't think it makes much difference, really. My wife and I had many little tiffs. I think I was a bit of a jealous bloke, or I was a bad-tempered bloke through those early days of the war. I know I was bad-tempered. I'd sometimes go half a day or a day and not speak. I'll admit that. And what did you ask me then?
I asked you about the tour of America.
Oh, yes. Well, anyway, we decided that we were parting. I said, my sister Mady in New York or Maine, wherever she was living then, would like me to go over. I said, I think I'd like to go over there, and I'd like to settle there. You don't seem to want me anymore. I'm going to, with your permission, because you have to get a wife's permission before you can emigrate. She said, I don't care where you go. I shan't stop you. And so I applied. Yes, America said they would have me, and my sister was looking forward to me going over. And so I went to America, and I stayed there a couple of years or so.
Can you remember what year it was when you went to America?
I think it must have been somewhere close on, or if not, 1926. I think it must be that.
And you stayed there for, what, 2 years?
Oh, about a couple of years, yes. Mm-hmm. I just got homesick at once and decided I'd... Well, a fellow I was... It was a funny country, America. Though I did a few shows there, I found it was very hard to break into show business in spite of what I told them I could do. I know I did many auditions. Nothing ever came of them. Whether they didn't want an Englishman, I don't know. But I didn't do very well in show business. I did tour around a bit, but...
Can you remember where you toured?
Sharing,
Can you remember where you were toured?
Oh dear, it sprung it on me right away. Geddesstone, Gettysburg, I remember that. Pennsylvania, all around Pennsylvania. And another place in Connecticut. Ah, Connecticut, Southern Rock. That's just outside New Haven. New Haven is a big college there. And I saw an ad in a paper. They wanted a man to run a funny kiosk in a fun city. I thought that suits me. So I applied, and he was an ex-Englishman, nice old boy, and he said, Yes, he rather liked it. Did I know anything about sideshows? I said, not much. Well, it isn't much. He said, it's a glass mirror maze. You get anybody in, and everywhere is a mirror, and whichever way they turn, you think they're going out, but they get further and further in. And he said, it's a rather a funny thing. And if you'd like, you can have the job, and it's in Savin Rock, Connecticut. That's a seaside place. So I had a long summer there at Savin Rock, and a lot of fun. If business wasn't good, if you'd only got about one or two people in the thing, and there were a lot of people outside looking, what I used to do was go inside, and I have a duster, and do that as if I was cleaning a big window. But actually, I was cleaning nothing, you see. But from the outside and from the inside, it looked as if I was cleaning one of the mirrors or one of the windows. So they just walked past me. And when they got several steps past me, they were landed, they were still inside. They had to go the whole of the way around the thing back to where the entrance was. And if I still wanted them in, I still continued doing the window. And I could keep anybody in there for hours at a time. And once or twice, one or two drunks started to run. Well, that's fatal in there. And some firemen were on a convention once, and he started doing funny business in there. So I showed him the way out, and he didn't like me chucking him out, because he said something about, that's your goddamn limey. I says, you rotten American bastard. Wallop! Hold that. And so I hit him, and he went backwards. He went through one of my plate glass windows. But he didn't sue me, and I got a new window put in. But lots of things like that happened in the... Then I came back, and I think I was a bit dissatisfied with life in America when I couldn't get into a show, and that mirror maze had folded up. And I thought, well, I had learned from my father-in-law a lot about wall and floor tiling. So I looked around, and I found someone, a man who wanted an assistant or a labourer. Though I was an efficient tiler, he could only take me on as a labourer, and making up the cement and the concrete and washing the tiles.
This is while you were still in America?
While I was in America. And one day he said, Prince. They always called me Prince. I used to look like the Prince of Wales in those days. Hey, Prince, he said, I'm sorry, I've got some bad news for you. I've got to fire you. And I said, why? I haven't done anything wrong. No, he said, the trouble is that you don't belong to any union, and I'm not allowed to hire any non-union men. So, Prince, you got the sack. You're fired.
Was it not possible for you to join?
No, no. They wouldn't. I said, I'll join you, a union. He said, no, you can't do that.
Would you know why that was?
No, I don't know why. It's the same as Equity in England, isn't it? You can't go and do a show if you don't belong to Equity. And you say, well, how do I join Equity? I say, search me. You can apply to join, and if you're something outstanding, they will accept you. But otherwise, I couldn't tell you how you do or how I joined the Plumbers Union. I couldn't tell you. Nobody could tell me. So that was that. Well, oh, and when I came back from America, which is worth putting in, really, I had got a little money, and my sister, of course, would see me all right. But... oh, yes, I took another job. It's funny how this comes back. I heard of one of the most exclusive clubs for gentlemen in New York, the Brook. Not called the Brook Club, the Brook. And all the big noises of America belonged to it and would look in every time they were in New York City, including our dear old Sir Thomas Lipton. Oh, I had many a chat with him, and... I said, you still sound very Cockney, sir. He said, well, you sound like a Cockney yourself. Are you a Cockney? I said, well, yes, I live at Tottenham. Huh. He said, well, you're my next door neighbour. He said, because I live at Hornsey. It was Hornsey or somewhere like that, anyway. So I had that job for some time.
What job exactly was that?
That was telephone. It was a small a small exchange where I could ring up and order cabs or anything that was wanted by telephone. I had this, well, I don't know what you call it.
Switchboard
thing, yes. But really hard to understand some of the American people. Somebody said they wanted something, and it sounded like something else, and they were insistent. They said, that's what I want. So, okay, I rang up somewhere, and I said, I want a two-horse chariot. They said, what? A two-horse chariot? You see, you're going back to Roman times, aren't you? Right, two-horse chariot. I said, well, that's for the gentleman. It's a very big car, it's a two-horse chariot. Oh, he said, yeah, I was thinking of a two-horse chariot. It was a 20-horse Chevrolet. No wonder they couldn't supply me with it. But it was very difficult anyway. And a fellow who worked there, I think he was in the kitchen, he said, I'm getting a bit tired of the station. He said, I'm going home. I said, well, I'm thinking of going there. He said, but I am going to do it in style. I've always come over and I've always been a steward on a boat. This time I've made enough money, I'm going back to England as a fair-paying passenger. I said, well, couldn't you have gone back without paying? Yes, he said, I could. He said, I've still got my pass, and if you like, I'll introduce you. If you want to go back, I'll get you taken on as an assistant steward, and it won't cost you anything, and you'll get a few bob in tips. So I said, that's an idea. So I got back to England without spending any money and got a few pound tips on the thing there. I was an assistant steward. And, well, that was it. There was another novel thing, anyway, coming back as a steward.
Can you remember anything particular about this voyage over from America?
No, except that as a steward, that's all I had to do was to wait at table. That was all, except they did ask questions around, is there anybody amongst the staff can do any entertaining? Well, of course, that had been my life, entertaining, so I put my hand, as in the army, yes, I could do it. So I did a show for them, and evidently it went very well, because the chief purser, who really, he was my boss, the chief purser, he said, there was a very good show you put on. I said, well, it's my business, surely. I'm not a full-time servant. I am a pro. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a job on this boat, and you can travel backwards and forwards, and as a nominal thing. You'll have no work to do, but you'll be called an assistant purser or assistant something, and you'll get paid for every show you do. But I said, sorry, but I've got to get back to England, because back to Tankerton, and they've offered to put me back in the show again, where I used to be.
I see, you knew that before.
I knew, yes, I did.
Can you remember the name of the ship that you were travelling on?
No, I cannot remember. I could remember the ones from India and all that, but I cannot remember the American one. No.
It was an American ship, was it, not a British one?
I couldn't tell you. No, I think it was British, because the personnel was British, so I guess it must have been a British ship. Mm.
You said you returned to Tankerton and returned to the show business there.
Yes.
Did your act change at all, or was there anything different about what you were doing there?
Well, I had learned some different songs and perhaps one or two tap dance steps since I left a couple of years before. But in a concert party of that type at Tankerton or any other place, you have to learn. If you're doing a summer season, a third of that season is taken up with rehearsing and learning. You want six programs, so it means that from before the show opens, you start rehearsing. And you've got to learn for every week. You've got to learn two fresh single songs. You will want at least two duets with somebody. In my case, it was with the wife. You'll have to learn at least two concerted numbers, that is the whole ensemble take part in, and the sketches. You have to learn two of those for every week, and if the season is 10 weeks long, it means you want almost 100 items you've got to learn prior to opening to halfway through the show, so that you could then jumble up all the things that you've learnt. What I did today on Thursday wouldn't come out again until next Friday. The next Friday one will come probably the following Saturday. It was all the programmes were mixed up, so it all seemed like a fresh programme.
Where did you get the material from? Did you write it yourself?
Or? No, as far as the songs go, the music publishers were very happy to supply us with copies. We used to call them professional copies of every song that they had or wrote or bought. They would have ordinary paper music and words, and they would send it to all the pros who wanted them, and then you would learn a song, and then you could buy proper copies of the song if you wanted to. If you didn't want to, it doesn't matter, you've learned your thing.
Did you have to pay if you used a song for the show? Did you have to pay?
No, not in a concert party, but you would in variety, you know, the big variety theatres. But no, not a concert party.
Perhaps before we go on any further, could you explain what the difference between variety and concert party is?
Yes, variety would be, well, I expect you've been to the Palladium and you've been to the London Hippodrome before it's changed hands. But London Palladium, we will take that. That is a number one variety theatre. And to get in there, you've got to be really clever to be on that bill. And anything that you use, millions of people will hear it with broadcasts and things, that you have to pay for the rights, the Performing Rights Society. Whereas concert party, it's just a little dribbly thing that wasn't worth it. They could sue you for using their material, but I've never heard of anybody being sued in concert party for using a song.
Would you say that basically concert party and variety were the same sort of entertainment?
It's the same sort of entertainment, except that one is what I would call Rolls Royce, that is the Palladium, would be the top notchers who get into that, whereas ordinary Jim Bloggs or Tommy Keel could be in concert party if he's lucky enough to have connected up with a concert party. But the same thing would happen in concert party as it did in the first class variety. You've each got your allotted time, and it is concert party, a variety show, but on a smaller scale, if you understand.
Yes,
a smaller scale.
You mentioned that the songs that you use and that the music publisher sent you the material. What about the patter that was devised? Was that something that you wrote yourself?
Some you would write yourself, or some you could buy. I don't know whether they still do, but in the stage newspaper, there used to be, probably still is, people who script writers who advertise scripts for sale. And you could buy the whole thing outright, perhaps for a fiver, you could get a very good double act.
Did you ever do that yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes, could do that. I was never clever enough to write a script to sell, but I have added things, and that's all I can't think of anything. You can buy scripts if you want, but how we make up scripts, I don't know. Maybe somebody has got a script and he's finished with it, and you think, I'd like that. It's like, have I got the right, could I use your old script if you don't want it? Yeah, you can have it for a quid. Could be the sort of thing like that.
Do you remember doing that yourself?
No, but I remember people pinching some of my stuff. In fact, one of my early broadcasts, when did I do it? Oh, yes, well, it's a bit further on in the next war, so I'll leave that one.
All right, fine. Could you tell me how long the summer season would go on for?
Approximately 10 weeks. I mean, a summer lasts about 10 weeks. Ours at Tankerton and Herne Bay, yes, they used to run the 10 weeks. But perhaps a smaller town might have a shorter summer season. It might be a bit less than that. But on the average, we reckon 10 weeks a concert party is run.
And in the shows that you were performing in, what sort of role did you play? I mean, I know that you did
I was what they call the light comedian. I wasn't what they call a low comedian. A low comedian is the red-nosed, funnily dressed one. But the light comedian is just as capable of being funny, and he is funny, but he's the smart, clean one, the light comedian. The well-dressed bloke. And he's always, the light comedian is always the feed. If you know what the feed is, I think everybody knows what a feed is. He's the feed to the red-nosed comic. That's why they do double acts, and the light comedian feeds the red-nosed comic the gags, and the red-nosed comic cracks the funny part of it.
Mm-hmm. We might call him a straight man.
Yes. Yes, the same as we came Morecambe and Wise. Morecambe was the funny one, the red-nosed one, we'll say, and Ernie Wise is the smart one. That is what a light comedian and a comedian means. So I was practically the top-notch light comedian. The comic is usually the number one man, but I'm afraid I ousted nearly all the red-nosed comics. They liked Tommy Keel better than they ever did the red-nosed comics.
So you were top of the bill, were you?
I was. They don't... in concert party, they don't really use top of the bill in the same way as a variety show would. No, I have one or two old bills where I was middle of the bill, and once when I was the bottom of the bill, which is almost as good as the top of the bill.
Can you remember which comics you worked with?
No. I can remember Kit Keane, who was a very good comic, but it's just so long ago, and he was pretty elderly then, and he must have been dead many, many years now. Kit Keane was a wonderful old-time comic who, can remember one of his things, clever things, was playing the spoons, which you never hardly ever see now.
What pressure did that put you under when you were such a popular act?
Yeah.
Did you feel a responsibility perhaps greater than other performers?
Yes, I did. I tell you why you know that you're always doing well. I learn, as I say, my two songs for that week. And they would let me sing my first song, and the applause was big enough to bring me back to do my second song. You all had to do two anyway. I did two, and I thought, well, that's it, I've finished my second song. No. Then the audience would start to applaud, and they kept on, and they kept on with om-bom-pong, om-bom-pong, om-bom-pong. And so they would keep on until I had to do it. Un Bon Pon was an Anglo-French song that they just loved, and I should think 8 times out of 10 times of performing, I had to do Un Bon Pon as a third.